Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm Dave Baxter and today I'm joined by Tim Creed. Tim's the Head of Investments for Europe at Schroders. He works on a couple of investment trusts you may already be familiar with. There's the Schroder British Opportunities Trust, which launched last year. And we also have the Schroder UK Public Private Trust. That latter name may be best known to you as what was once the Woodford Patient Capital Trust, which Schroders took over in late 2019. So, Tim, thanks very much for joining. We can get on a bit later into exactly how the two trusts differ. But I suppose what's really interesting is they both focus on the UK, but they're not limited just to listed stocks. They can also go in various ways into the unlisted space. And the UK, of course, in the last 6 months or so, has been an incredibly interesting market. You've seen a lot of share price momentum. You've seen plenty of IPOs, and you've also seen lots of private equity money kind of moving around, lots of acquisitions and potential acquisitions. We've seen recently WM Morrison, some interesting news there. But now that we've seen all of that, and now perhaps people are getting a bit more wary about things like prospects for economic growth, where are the kind of opportunities in the UK? Are there kind of differences in terms of what's going on in the listed, unlisted space? And is there anywhere that you think is potentially getting a little bit overheated after such, you know, rip-roaring 6 months or so?
Perfect. Hello there. Well, yes, thank you for the question. So we as Schroders obviously cover the whole of the investment landscape. And the two trusts that I'm very closely involved in cover the public and private equity landscape. So we cover, and my role as being head of investments for private equity is I cover all the venture capital, growth capital, and private equity buyout investments in these two trusts. And I work with colleagues who focus on the public investments that go into the same trusts. So if you look at the last 6 months or so, we are at record highs for take privates. But we're also quite interesting. We're at record highs for IPOs. So we're in a period where there's a lot of change going on. Now, many people are speculating what's caused that change. Could it be Brexit? Could it be COVID? To be honest, it could be many different topics. But what we certainly do see is there is change. And one of the views that we hold dearly is that the private investments, so venture, growth and buyouts, is very interesting. And public investments is very interesting. So we don't see the world as black or white, as one or the other. We see that both types of ownership structure have their strengths and have their merits. And even for one company, there can be the right ownership structure at one point in time, and then the ownership structure might be right as a different ownership structure sometime later. So we believe it's really important to be able to invest across both public and private, and to be able to offer investors the opportunity to access both public and private. But you are also right. There has been a lot of talk about what's going on, and there's certainly areas of the market where there's a bit more capital going into those segments. And so one of the phrases that we use quite frequently is capital supply and demand. We like to focus on areas where there's either insufficient capital or the right amount of capital. And we tend to avoid areas where we feel there's excess capital. And we've learned that over many, many years. If you look in the private side, this was most true in venture capital in 99-2000. Venture capital had been really attractive in the years leading up to that. That led to too much money going into venture capital in the turn of the century. And then when there was too much money in venture capital in 2000, the returns started to drop. It was the same in mid and large buyout in 2007, 8, and 9, when those segments were really attractive and high performing for a number of years. And then meant that by 2008, there was a bit too much capital there. And when there's too much capital, there was the return started to drop. So we spend a lot of time and attention looking at how much capital is in different segments. And I'll say that across most of the private sector, so venture, growth, and buyouts, capital supply and demand is in appropriate balance. The one area where I think you've got to be a bit careful is at the very large, late stage venture end. There's a bit of danger there's too much capital there. So we're a bit underweight in late stage venture, but we're an active investor across the rest of the private spectrum.
And how does it play out if you look at it more in terms of kind of sectors? Are there any areas where you recently have found yourself kind of, you know, focusing more closely on any areas where you think at the minute, you know, perhaps there's too much capital, or perhaps on the other side of things, valuations are perhaps a bit concerning?
So by sector, the Schroders Capital private equity team focuses on five sectors. Mm-hmm. We focus on IT, we focus on healthcare, and then consumer, industrials, and business services. And there's probably two things I'd like to highlight. The first is, although I say we focus on the five sectors, it really is the first two sectors, the healthcare sector and the IT sector, where we have the bulk of our capital. So about 60% of our capital is in those two sectors. And that's been a long-term dynamic. We've really liked investing in healthcare and in technology for the last 20 plus years, and they've been very attractive to us. It's obviously taken a bit of a step up in the last year, last year and a half through the world of COVID, as many other people have also joined us in those sectors. So we've had to be careful to avoid the areas within IT and healthcare where there is too much money. But those two sectors definitely remain our most interesting and exciting sectors. There was also a couple of sectors I didn't mention. So I didn't mention oil and gas or commodities or big financial services, big banks, insurance companies, etc. We tend to avoid those. And that's because within the private equity and venture capital market, those kind of companies don't really exist. We also, I should say, have a very high ESG governance standard, so we don't invest in tobacco or weapons or anything like that either.
And I suppose when you talk about kind of tech and healthcare in the UK, that's quite, as you said, it's been a very topical space in the last year, 18 months. But the UK has such an interesting relationship, I suppose, with the tech space in particular. You have these concerns about you know, UK companies, promising companies being gobbled up by kind of foreign entities. How much of a problem do you view that as? And is there anything you can kind of mitigate, or any way you can mitigate that threat as an investor?
Certainly. Well, one data point I like to put forward that most people are unaware of is that if you look at venture capital, growth capital, and buyout, and you look at where most companies are sold, so kind of the exit for most venture growth and buyout, about some 90 plus percent of all exits are actually to trade buyers. So 90% of all the exits that happen within private equity are to either UK corporates or international corporates, or to UK private equity firms or international private equity firms. So it's less than 10% of all the exits are actually IPO. However, of course, it's those IPOs that get the most attention. And then there's a lot of attention as to whether they IPO on a UK exchange or whether they IPO primarily in the US as the most logical alternative. From our perspective, we like to see our companies really grow through the 5 to 7 to 10 year ownership that we have. And then when it is time for us to exit those companies, we do like to see those companies go to a good home that is going to help continue to grow those companies. So whether it's a trade buyer or whether it's an IPO, for us, as long as we see further growth for those companies, then we're happy. At the same time, we as Schroders are a very large institutional investor across the UK landscape. And so we as Schroders have made a number of announcements and statements to say that we would like to see more UK companies listing on the UK exchange. And actually our CEO, Peter Harrison, has been pretty vocal on this topic, talking about potential changes to regulations that could happen or could be required in order to increase the likelihood of more technology companies, more healthcare companies listing in the UK.
I suppose it'd be interesting also to see if we see companies, I suppose, taking more of their own measures. So for example, one of what was, and I imagine still is, one of your prominent holdings in Schroder UK Public Private, Oxford Nanopore, they've been looking at kind of like an anti-takeover structure in the upcoming IPO. So I don't know, is that something you're kind of seeing more of, like companies being a bit more perhaps proactive in trying to kind of keep control or, you know, offset some of these potential risks?
So it's an interesting question. Actually, as a platform, as a Schroders Capital private equity team, we've been investing in venture and growth and buyout globally for over 20 years. And so we're actually very big investors, and we're very early investors in US venture back in the 90s. And so we've had access both through our fund investments, where we invest into a venture capital fund, but also through our co-investments and direct investments. We've had access to some of the great venture capital companies and great kind of stories and tech businesses that have been built up over the last 20 years. Primarily in the US, but also across the UK and across Europe, and also in Asia. And there has, in those other markets, particularly in the US, it's been quite a long-term characteristic that there's been dual class of shares for founders as well as for compared to other people. And so that's quite a standard, I would say, in US venture capital. So we're quite experienced at dealing with that. I think it's certainly clear that that's not so common in the UK. But it is something that we are now seeing more and more businesses look to either put in place on day one when they're being set up, or at the time when they see that an IPO is likely.
And I suppose generally, staying with the kind of tech and healthcare space, how do you kind of deal with, you've mentioned there's been a lot of focus on those areas from other investors. I'm always interested in how investors cope with, I suppose, that flood of money. What kind of difference does it make to your due diligence and I suppose how you kind of consider things you already hold? What's the impact there?
So we believe fundamentally in a bottom-up approach. So we believe fundamentally that you've got to look at the company and what it stands for. So you've got to look at the company itself, so its product, its positioning, its competitive landscape, etc. You've got to look at the management of that company and the board of that company, and you've got to look at the co-investors who are sort of the other people who are investing in the company. And for private investments, that's particularly important. So we cover kind of that bottom-up analysis of looking at these companies from that perspective. What we find is once you get to, if you're looking at seed stage, early stage, or kind of small, kind of the earlier rounds of venture, you tend not to see particularly high valuations. Where things start to get a bit more frothy is in the late stage venture. And this is because these companies have often had a great history of success for a number of years. They're starting to really make their mark externally, either domestic within the UK or internationally. And a number of other investors try and jump on, try and also join these companies. For us, we're always keen to have other like-minded, experienced investors invest alongside us in our successful business. We've had a long-term phrase within the world of venture capital, which is when it talks about a piece of pie, it's better to have a small piece of a much bigger pie than trying to control the pie yourself. And so we've always been very collaborative at bringing in other co-investors into the businesses that we work with. And the challenge is, though, when you get into the late stage and there's some people who are maybe, or some firms who are maybe a bit less experienced, and they're coming into technology and healthcare in particular in the last couple of years. So we spend quite a lot of time working with the management teams to make sure the management teams themselves also choose the right kind of co-investors in the business. Because what we like to do is at any stage that we invest, we like to hold a company for 3 to 5 to 7 years. But even if we do a top-up investment in year kind of 5, we do like to see that company has got a long future ahead. Because even at the point that we wish to sell, we need to know that there's a great future ahead, because obviously that helps the sale opportunity. So looking at the quality of co-investors is something that we're very careful about. It does mean that we clearly look at valuations through that journey. But if you invest into a really high-quality business, a lot of the rest takes care of itself.
Do you find, I imagine this is something that seems to apply perhaps in both the listed and unlisted space, particularly when it comes to kind of growth stories. But do you find that over recent history, you've perhaps had to become a bit more relaxed about things like valuations?
No, definitely not. I definitely wouldn't say that. I'd say that's we look at that very thoroughly. It's a key part of a business. I have heard various different, and we've talked about this within our investment teams and our investment committee. If you're investing in a high quality business, then does the valuation matter as much? And I say it still does matter, because it determines how long you're going to hold those companies. We like to make 3 to 5 times our money on our investments. Now, clearly, we don't do that on all. In some cases, we do a bit worse. In many cases, we do substantially better. But we really underwrite our investments to a perspective that they can make 3 to 5 times your money. And so we wouldn't want to then invest into a company at an ultra high valuation with much lower return expectations, because that wouldn't fit alongside the other investments in any vehicle that we do.
Interesting. And I suppose it'd be quite useful just to go through with each of the two trusts we're discussing, the different kinds of activity you are involved in when it comes to unlisted stocks, because I suppose this is an area people are getting increasingly interested in. You've seen some very good returns from spaces like private equity in the last year or so. But there are obviously different ways to approach those kind of unlisted companies. So how does it work in those two trusts?
SUPP is a vehicle that you mentioned that we took over in December 19. And SBO is one we launched as an IPO in December 2020. So the two vehicles, there's two main differences. The first difference is that SUPP is really venture and growth, whereas SBO is more growth and buyout. So SUPP is venture growth and SBO growth and buyout. The second difference is that SUPP already contained a lot of companies because it was invested by another manager. And so we took it over and we knew that we would need to do a lot of changes to that portfolio. We would have to change the companies themselves. We'd have to do a number of sales, we'd have to change the direction of companies before we were able to make new investments. And even now, we have made our first investment, which we're really pleased about, our first private investment. So we're really pleased about that. But even now, it's only going to be a couple of investments until we've done more sales. Whereas SBO, we launched as an IPO, and that meant on day one, we had the capital to make investments. And so we're actually making investments. We've made six investments in the private side within the last 6 months, as well as making a substantial number of public investments. So SUPP is really a vehicle that is one that we're kind of reshaping. SBO is one that really sits front and center for what we stand for.
Yeah. So we'll definitely get more into that portfolio activity because there's a lot of interesting stuff there. But briefly, for listeners who perhaps aren't as familiar with those terms, how would you very briefly explain things like venture, buyout and growth?
Thank you. That's a good question, a very fair question. So, and actually, if you ask five people, you might get 10 different definitions.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I'll give you my definition. So venture capital is normally very fast-growing, loss-making companies. So it might, when they first started, it started in something called seed investing. And this might be one or two people who start a company with a great idea. And they'll spend months or years building out that company, starting to recruit people. But to do that, they need external capital to help them grow that company. And that's venture capital. So the venture capital investments, you might often invest maybe and acquire maybe 10 or 20% of a company, and the entrepreneurs will keep the rest. They'll often be in the tech space. The companies might need 3, 4, 5, 6 rounds of funding. And so those rounds are called seed stage, and then series A, series B, series C, series D, series E, etc. And the hope in many of those companies is for it to go to an IPO. Whereby for the Series A all the way up to Series D, E, they're likely to be significantly loss-making companies and really kind of aiming for rapid growth. Growth capital has almost the same growth rates, but slightly slower growth rates, but they're slightly more established businesses. They're normally companies that are already kind of much closer to profitability, and in some cases actually already quite profitable companies. But they're companies that really need more capital in order to grow. So they need to, for example, one investment that we've invested in, the company wanted to recruit an extra 100 people. And to do that is obviously quite a costly endeavor. And so they did a growth capital round. We invested into that business and then they continued to help them grow further. And then the final one, the buyout investments. These are investments where we will generally buy the whole company. We'll generally, with our private equity partner, buy anything from kind of 60% to 100%. We actually like to buy 60 or 70% so that the management team and also employees can continue to own the company. We're a big believer in employee ownership. Mm. And the idea of these companies is these companies are normally going to be really profitable, really high quality companies. And one phrase I do like to say about private equity, a lot of people think of private equity as a potentially turnaround or potentially cutting companies up. But actually the vast majority, probably 95% of buyout investments and private equity investments are where you buy a good company and you make it great. So you buy a company that is already doing really well, and then you grow it even faster. So that would be how I would describe venture, growth, and buyout.
Getting back to then, you started to talk a bit about what's going on in the trusts. I think a lot of people will be interested in particular in SUPP, given there will be people who invested perhaps a few years ago. It's had a very kind of rocky ride. Given it used to be the Woodford Patient Capital Trust, as you mentioned, that's quite an interesting story because I suppose you're managing an existing portfolio, much of which will, I imagine, be quite illiquid, quite tricky to kind of shift, at least in the kind of shorter term. What's going on there? You know, what have been the ups and downs? Even this year, we've perhaps seen some good news and some bad news for that portfolio. What are you up to now there?
Yes, so SUPP, Schroder UK Public Private Trust, is indeed quite a journey. You're right, so we took it over from another investment manager, and it was at the time of the launch, some years ago, one of the largest new IPOs for an investment trust ever. Yeah. So it had quite a big start. It was rapidly invested. It faced a lot of challenges in the summer of 2019. And so, and I should say, this trust is separate from the other vehicles that were run by the former manager as well. So that there was always a distinguishing something separate about this investment trust to the manager's other vehicles. So the board of this investment trust actually ran a process from June 2019 all the way through until December to find a new manager. Mm. Now that was a very competitive process. It was a very well-run process. We know of quite a number of other investment firms, both public firms as well as private equity firms, who completed the due diligence or went through the analysis and the comparison, the bidding process. And at the end of that process, Schroders were selected. So we really, the reason from our perspective that we want to take it over is twofold. The first is the one I've already mentioned, which is we felt that an investment trust structure is a great structure to allow retail investors to access private equity, as had been proven by the fact this vehicle had launched in the first place. And it had a great number and volume of retail investors up and down the country. The second reason we took it over is, although there was a lot of problems within the portfolio, we felt that there were some interesting companies. But perhaps more importantly, we felt there were some companies that if we could move them into the right direction, they could become really interesting companies. And so a lot of people, when they ask us about what we've done, they ask us, what have we sold? What have we bought? Mm-hmm. And we have done some sales, and we have now done an investment, our first new private investment. But actually, the vast majority of the work has been spent on changing the direction of the existing companies and getting them to move into the right direction. So one example would be a company called Kymab, which was a company that not many people had much interest in when we took over the investment trust. There was talk of a new funding round. So it was a new venture round at a significantly lower valuation than the previous funding round, which is always a bit of a negative story within venture if that happens. And so there's a lot of negativity about that company. The company itself wanted to go for an IPO at some point in the future, and so it needed more money if that was to be the case. And so they wanted to go down this funding round. Our view was consistent with the statement that only about 10% of companies ever actually go for the IPO. Our view is you should also always look at the trade sale path or how you can work with corporates. And in this case, it was a healthcare company. So it's how you could work with Big Pharma. So we worked really closely with the management and the rest of the board and the rest of the shareholders to try and help them move away from the path of a new financing round and towards the path of working with Big Pharma, either as some form of strategic partnership and or potentially as a sale. That took a year. It takes quite a lot of time to work with a lot of people with different views, both, as I say, with the management and also the board and also other shareholders. There were people who fully agreed with us, so we were not the lone voice, but there were also people who disagreed with us. And so it spent quite a lot of time. During that journey, by the summer of 2020, some of the other shareholders didn't like what was going on, and we actually invested we bought shares, about £1 million worth of shares from other investors in the kind of, I'd say, almost the peak of Corona time as well. It was quite a challenging time last summer. And by the end of the year, that company was really was going down a successful path of partnership discussions with Big Pharma as well as potential trade sale. And it culminated in that company being bought by a large French Big Pharma company. And we made nearly about 10 times our money on the investment that we'd made in the previous summer, and about 10 times our money on the holding value of the company when we took it over. So in other words, we helped the company be sold for far higher valuation and be a really successful exit. It's an exit with an earnout. So the company has to continue doing well within Sanofi, which is the French pharma company. But it was an example, I think, that shows that if you work with the management and with the board and with the rest of the shareholders, that the biggest way that you can create value in investment is by making sure it goes in the right direction rather than just selling the shares, as was demonstrated by the success there. And so I should say that when we did that sale, we announced the sale to the stock exchange in January this year for SUPP. And then actually only within the last few weeks, SUPP has received the cash from that sale. And that's enabling us to make further new investments elsewhere.
And you have, as you mentioned, you have made at least one new investment, haven't you?
Yes, we made our first investment into a technology business called Tessian. It's a really exciting, fast-growing security software business based in the UK that we think has got a very strong future ahead.
And what you mentioned, it's quite interesting. I suppose you focus on the companies held in that portfolio, those legacy holdings. And you've had, as I said, you've had some ups and downs. You had a bit of a write-down with, I believe, names like Atom Bank and Rutherford Health earlier this year. How do you deal with those issues, and what specifically do you try and what action do you implement to try and sort of improve the prospects for those holdings?
Yeah, so I mean, across the whole portfolio, when we look at the SUPP portfolio in aggregate, it's often sometimes kind of two steps forward, one step back, because we didn't make some of the initial investments, so we're having to move them into the right direction. But the aggregate journey is definitely one of positivity and definitely one of moving in the right direction, as been shown by not just the Kymab exit, but also an IPO of a company called Immunocore, which I'll get back to if we wish to cover that. But we do also have to face challenges, and the write-downs in Atom Bank and in Rutherford, they were two of the three largest companies. And so when you have a write-down in one of the largest companies, that has a material impact on the NAV. At the same time, we think that those two companies are now much stronger, and the valuation of those companies reflects much truer where they are. We also look at valuation as that point, the value of that company at that point of time. But then we also factor in the topic about what we're going to do next. How is that company going to grow? And I'd say that in both cases, in Rutherford and in Atom Bank, we feel that they have potentially very exciting futures ahead. Atom Bank is the leader in its field. It basically allows people to buy mortgages on their mobile phones. They've got a really state-of-the-art IT platform. People talk about fintech, and the word fintech is quite broad. And if we wish to go down that path, we can talk extensively about fintech. This is a business that has really spent its time building out its IT platform rather than just growing at all costs. So it's taken an unusual approach, possibly a slower approach, which helps to explain the down valuation. But at the same time, it means that the company is in a very strong position right now. So for us, it's a topic about make sure the companies are moving in the right direction, and spend more time on that than worrying about the valuation. I should also make sure that I state proactively that we as Schroders don't do the valuations. We can provide inputs and guidance and thoughts about the valuations, but the valuations on the trust are done independently by another party and not by ourselves.
So it sounds then like you would, perhaps even in a couple of years, few years' time, would you, broadly speaking, have a similar portfolio to what you inherited?
No, I think there will be some companies that we hope that we are still owning. A company like Oxford Nanopore, we think is a really magnificent company, and we definitely want, at this stage, our expectation is to be a long-term shareholder. Of course, it's now some 25%+ of the portfolio, which is a bit large if you think about building out a diversified portfolio. So it may be that sometime a long time after the IPO, we may consider downsizing the position slightly, but that would be a reflection on our own portfolio, not on the company, because we think very highly of the company. But there are indeed other companies that we've already been through a process, and we've sold a number of companies now. So the names of the companies, there's more than 10 companies or so that are no longer in the portfolio compared to the day that we took over. I think what we really want to do is, if you look at the portfolio, it's got quite a healthcare focus, which is something that I think that was one of the reasons we were chosen to take over, because we have such a healthcare presence. But at the same time, although we love healthcare, this is perhaps a bit too focused on healthcare. And so most of the new investments that we'll do will be outside of the healthcare space in order to bring a bit more balance to the portfolio. And then I think you'll start to see the types of companies that we invest into, so like Tessian and many other companies of that nature.
Yeah, what kind of sectors would you broaden out to?
Definitely technology, possibly further into fintech. And then with time, we can also go into both business services and consumer. I think it's unlikely to have much industrials because I mentioned that SUPP is venture and growth. In venture, you don't really see industrials. In growth, you could possibly. But I think SBO would be the one that would be more balanced across all of our five sectors. But SUPP will retain a much stronger focus on both healthcare and IT and then have a bit of consumer and a bit of business services and fintech.
And you mentioned kind of position sizing. This portfolio, I suppose, in the former days under Woodford has been very concentrated. Do you have an idea in mind of things like position sizes and broader concentration of the portfolio you would like to get to make it a bit more diversified?
So definitely. And I should say that in both cases, I am one of two portfolio managers. So in SUPP, it's myself and another colleague. In SBO, it's myself and another colleague. But in both vehicles, the two named portfolio managers are just two people of large teams. So we have a large public team and a large private team working on both of the trusts and therefore all the companies. So I should want to definitely proactively mention that although I'm speaking, I'm really just representing quite a large team that are working on this. And I think that's really important because the way that we operate is we're really actively involved in both sourcing new investments, but the way that we actively manage the companies we're involved in is a very time-consuming process, and so it requires a lot of resources. So going to what we're going to do next, our philosophy is very much to build a position of equal-sized investments. So if you look at SBO, which I think is better reflective of how we think, each of the private investments that we've made so far, and we've made six, they all start off being about the same size. So we don't take the approach of putting what's called kind of a toehold investment in many companies and then seeing where it will go. Instead, our approach is if we believe in something, we invest in it. If we don't believe in it, we don't invest in it. And so each of the investments in SBO have been the same size. In the case of SUPP, because it's a bit more venture and growth, there may be a bit of a broader range of investment sizes, because if we do need to make one further round of financing, we want to make sure that we reserve for it and if the company doesn't get lopsided by multiple rounds of financing.
Well, would you have a rough idea of a kind of limit on position size or anything like that?
I think it's unlikely that we'd make a new investment that's above 5%. And definitely not above 10% of SUPP, and similar ratios for SBO.
Yeah. And with SBO, that's, I suppose, quite an interesting launch. It was one of three, the only one of three last year that managed to get away trying to go with a new UK trust. But what caught my eye at the time was you were talking about this kind of what you dubbed a once-in-a-generation opportunity to, I suppose, kind of capitalize on this deep need for capital from companies, both listed and unlisted, in the wake of the pandemic. Is that a theme you see as kind of long lasting, or is there a point at which you would think, actually, we need to perhaps, you know, tweak what we focus on?
So it certainly was an interesting time to launch. We originally started talking about the trust in about March or about April time last year with Rory Bateman, who's the global head of equities. He's my fellow portfolio manager on SBO, Schroders British Opportunities Trust. And he and I first started talking about it in April, as I say. It took some time for us to make sure that we really wanted to do it, make sure we had the appropriate teams in place, all the infrastructure in place, all the governance, because we're, as an organization like Schroders, you can imagine that all the appropriate checks and balances need to be in place. And we also wanted to make sure that we built out a pipeline that was really substantial. That was particularly true on the private side, but it was also true on the public side. And so from day one, we felt that from the point of launching, where I should say that we actually went through our official launch was during the month of November. Mm-hmm. So as Boris Johnson put the country into lockdown two, we then started our roadshow, which did actually save us quite a lot of time on because we didn't have to travel by planes, trains, cars and buses. We could do everything by Zoom and video conferencing. But we did the whole roadshow remotely. And that culminated in the launch at the beginning of December 2020. But it meant we also had full pipelines ready to be implemented on day one. And this really is where the phrase that the opportunity of a lifetime came from. We felt that both on the public side and the private side, we had never seen as many interesting companies. And if you go back to kind of coming through the lockdown, that's quite an interesting sentence to say that we'd never seen so many interesting companies, because what we saw is there was really two types of companies. So disregarding the public-private, there were two types. There was the first type, which was companies who were genuinely super strong companies that went into the pandemic in a good position, but through their position or through their niche or their industry or their management, their growth accelerated far faster than anyone could have predicted during the course of 2020. So these were the companies that might have been growing at 30%, but started growing at over 100% because of what happened. So there were companies, particularly in the healthcare and technology space. I mean, a lot of people think of a company like Amazon in the US, which obviously did do very well, but there were other companies in the UK that were growing at similar rates. And so we saw a number of really exciting companies that some of them just needed more money to basically almost deliver the growth that they were experiencing. The second type of company that we liked were companies that were formerly, were always really, really good companies, but because of either where they operated or the industry they're in, they had struggled. Some of them had seen revenues drop off or EBITDA drop off. Some had seen clients stop. So big projects that just got stopped, as you can imagine, as everyone experienced during the course of last year. But we felt that with those companies, they were doing something that meant that as they came out of the pandemic, they would come out stronger. And so some of them did a bit of repositioning. Some of them were even logistics companies, believe it or not, or transport companies. But we felt that they were going to come out of the pandemic in a stronger position. But in many cases, they needed a bit of extra money. And that was both in the private side, but it was also on the public side where there was secondary issuances being being done. And so we felt that with a bit of capital, we could put more money into the first type of companies, which was super fast growing companies, but also the second type of company to help them kind of return to their former glory. Or even, we like to talk about it internally as going faster and better than they were previous to the pandemic.
So with, particularly with that second group, do you think then, do you have a bit more of a cyclical exposure here than you might, for example, in SUPP?
So it's a fair question to ask. We don't think so. It's possible that at this very point of time, because SUPP is far more healthcare, that it's possibly the case. But what we've tried to do is invest into companies where we're very confident about its future. So I'll give one example from SBO. It's a company called Easy Park. We actually got approval to invest in the business a year ago, so in the summer of 2020. And then obviously with the pandemic, there was a few things going on. So it actually took more than a year for that company to close. And the reason that it took so long for the deal to close is because Easy Park were buying their main competitor, which is a company called ParkNow, and they carved that out of BMW and Daimler. So that whole transaction took a year, but it also meant that we had a year of watching how that business developed through COVID. And so it's a company that, I'm going to make it sound very, very simple. It has an app to help you pay for your parking. And I deliberately make it sound simple, because if you think of parking, most people put coins in meters to pay for your parking, and then they kind of drive around the town looking for new car parking spaces. There's a number of apps out there that you can have either on your phone or in your car, such as Ringo or other apps that allow you to pay for your parking on your mobile phone. In almost many of these cases, those apps are actually owned by Easy Park ParkNow, so such as Ringo. That's one of the apps and one of the brands that Easy Park run. And so it enables people to pay for their parking, as opposed to having to on their phone instead of having to look for coins. Now, what we did see through calendar year 2020 is the use of cars obviously stopped as people were in lockdown. But what we were able to see is, and it's a company that now operates in over 2,000 cities globally. And so it's a very, very diverse business. And we got to see, and the company got to see, how people return to car usage through and after COVID. And what we also saw is, interestingly, something we hadn't predicted, which is as we came through COVID, a lot of people didn't want to touch coins anymore. And so the move to digitization is a theme that we liked when we invested into Easy Park and when we took it through our investment committee, that was part of our thesis, but it became a far more dominant part of the thesis by the time that we made the investment a couple of months ago from SBO. And so what we do feel is something like that is a good example where COVID and the challenge of the last year has transformed some business and moved them forward by many years rather than just the kind of 1 year annual growth.
One of those acceleration stories. Well, lots to think about there, but I'm afraid we're out of time. So thank you, Tim, very much for joining today, and thank you everyone for listening.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.